Okay, good evening, everyone. My name is Kim, and I am a recovered compulsive overeater from South Jersey.
Hi.
I'm so happy to be here. This is my first time flying cross-country, first time in a different time zone. It's kind of weird. So I'm just so grateful to be here. Just to tell you a little bit about me, I am very grateful today not to be a size 24. Where in my early 20s, I couldn't even walk up a flight of stairs without having to stop because I was short of breath. I also got down to a size 2, where my hair was falling out and I lost my menstrual cycle. And I've also been the size I am now, binging and purging and over-exercising. So one of the first things we're going to learn today is that food and weight is not my problem, because I have gotten abstinent hundreds of times, and if that was really my problem, I would have been okay. I've also lost weight dozens of times, and that did not make it okay. So what I'm hoping to do tonight is basically go over steps 1 and 2, the chapters in the big book, which is where I found my personal recovery. And then tomorrow morning, do steps 3 and 4. And then after lunch, we're going to do 5 through 11 and maybe even 12, depending on how much time. I do want to kind of like have interaction. So I think, is that the Ask It Basket there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're going to have an Ask It Basket. If you want to ask a question and don't feel comfortable saying it out loud, you can put it in there. Otherwise, what we're going to do is probably talk. I'll probably talk like 50 minutes to 60 minutes so that you guys don't fall asleep. And then we'll stop and we'll have some questions, and then we'll probably take like a 10-minute break and then start up again around 7:30. And same thing, I'll talk for like 40, 50 minutes. We do have to be out of the room by 9. So I'm thinking what I'll try to do is wrap up around 8:30 and leave time for questions, and then we can get out of here by 9 o'clock tonight. And I did have some readings that I thought were really kind of cool. So, of course, the first one I'm missing. So would someone want to come up and read the 1940 AA preamble, which I thought is very interesting. This is what they read in the 1940s. Beth? I remembered your name. That's pretty good.
Nice. Different times and everything.
Yeah.
I'm Beth. I'm a compulsive eater.
Hi, Beth.
We are gathered here because we are faced with the fact that we are powerless over alcohol and unable to do anything about it without the help of a power greater than ourselves. We feel that each person's religious views, if any, are their own affair. The simple purpose of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is to show what may be done to enlist the aid of a power greater than ourselves, regardless of what our individual conception of that power may be. In order to form a habit of depending upon and referring all that we do to that power, we must at first apply ourselves with some diligence. By often repeating these acts, they become habitual, and the help rendered becomes natural to us. We have all come to know that as alcoholics, we are suffering from a serious illness for which medicine has no cure. Our condition may be the result of an allergy, which makes us different from other people. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently cured. The only relief we have to offer is absolute abstinence, the second meaning of AA. There are no dues or fees. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. Each member squares his debt by helping others to recover. An Alcoholics Anonymous is an alcoholic who, through application and adherence to the AA program, has forsworn the use of any and all alcoholic beverage in any form. The moment he takes so much as one drop of beer, wine, spirits, or any other alcoholic beverage, he automatically loses all status as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. AA is not interested in sobering up drunks who are not sincere in their desire to remain sober for all time. Not being reformers, we offer our experience only to those who want it. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and on which we can join in harmonious action. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our program. Those who do not recover are people who will not or simply cannot give themselves to this simple program. Now, you may like this program or you may not, but the fact remains, it works. It is our only chance to recover. There's a vast amount of fun in the AA fellowship. Some people might be shocked at our seeming worldliness and levity, but just underneath there lies a deadly earnestness and a full realization that we must put first things first, and with each of us, the first thing is our alcoholic problem. To drink is to die. Faith must work 24 hours a day in and through us, or we perish. In order to set our tone for this meeting, I ask that we bow our heads in a few moments of silent prayer and meditation. I wish to remind you that whatever is said at this meeting expresses our own individual opinion as of today and as of up to this moment. We do not speak for AA as a whole, and you are free to agree or disagree as you see fit. In fact, it is suggested that you pay no attention to anything which might not be reconciled with what is in the AA Big Book. If you don't have a Big Book, it's time you bought one. Read it, study it, live with it, loan it, scatter it, and then learn from it what it means to be an AA.
Thanks, Beth.
I attend an AA meeting, even though I'm not an alcoholic, because I need this solution, and this is what it starts out with. And I just love it, because it shows how serious they are, that the purpose of an AA meeting is to teach people that they need to put the alcohol down 100%, that the goal is to recover from this illness, and that it's earnest and serious, and yet there's love and there's joyous, you know, there's levity in there. And I think that's the tone I want to create, you know, here. We want to get really serious about our disease, but we want to take ourselves so seriously, you know, and the idea that we square our debt by carrying the message. I mean, that's so important. If you have this message, there are so many people out there that are suffering, that it's our job now to let other people know there is a way out. So what we're going to do is, and I think it's wonderful you guys got these study editions. I don't know if any of you have ever seen them before, but they're very popular in my area because it's one side is the page and the other side is notes. So I hope you guys get a lot out of this where you can take a lot of notes. So we're going to start out in the doctor's opinion. And I guess I want to start out, does anybody here, like, I don't know how much you guys use the Big Book. Is this anybody's first, you know, like, exposure to the Big Book? Or do you guys kind of use it a lot in this area?
What was your question?
Has anyone never been exposed to the Big Book? Great, okay. So I'm going to go over this and hopefully be just stressing some really important points. So the foundation of the Big Book is the doctor's opinion. It explains to us what our problem is. Because if we don't have the problem, then why do we care anything about the rest of the book? It really is the foundation stone. So who Dr. Silkworth was is he is a neurologist that worked in New York City in Towns Hospital. And it's estimated he worked with about 50,000 alcoholics. And what he started to notice was a pattern. There were a certain number of alcoholics that would come into the hospital, and he would dry them out, and they would leave the hospital, and he would never see them again. And there was another percentage of them that they would come back a couple times, and he would sit them down after they were dried out and say, you know what, I don't think you can handle your liquor. My suggestion is don't ever drink. And that was enough for those people to leave the hospital and never come back. But there was a certain percentage, he estimated about 10%, that no matter how many times he physically dried them out, and no matter how many times he explained the consequences when they drank, they would return over and over and over. And that is the type of alcoholic that this book is written for. And now I know I've seen on the news many times that 2/3 of Americans are obese. I don't think 2/3 of Americans are compulsive overeaters. We're going to learn in here about what a hard eater is and what a moderate eater is. So this book is really for people that is going to fit this definition of alcoholism. We're going to hear words like the chronic alcoholic, an alcoholic of our type, as seriously alcoholic as we are. So step one is really the admission, do we have this problem? There's a wonderful AA speaker, Sandy B, that I love, and I went to a meeting this morning in your area, and I talked about it because I love it. In one sentence, he summarizes an alcoholic. An alcoholic is someone who cannot eat safely, I'm going to say for us, cannot eat safely, and cannot be abstinent contently. So that's what we're going to be talking about, is that dangerous interaction of allergy of the body and obsession of the mind. Because if we have one or the other, we probably don't need to do the 12 steps. The 12 steps are actually based on the Oxford group, which was a religious group in the 1920s. And it wasn't for alcoholics. It was for people who wanted to have a connection with God. What happened was is these alcoholics came in and they knew they either got a relationship with a power greater than themselves or they were going to die. So for us, it's life and death. Other people will benefit from the 12 steps just because it's a good program to help you get a relationship with power. But we have to understand for us, to drink is to die, which is also in that reading we had. So let's turn to page XXVIII in the doctor's opinion. which is Roman numeral 28. So let's find out what it means to have an allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. So on that first full I check to see if that's the number in your book. I'm assuming it is.
It's not.
It's not. It's Roman numeral 28. But does your, is your doctor's opinion have the pages there?
Yeah. 23 is the beginning, but 28 is a choice.
Okay, in your book it's XXVI. So this must be, this is using the third edition's page numbers, because it was two pages difference between the third edition and the fourth edition. So XXVI is what it is in your book. Okay? So the first paragraph there, we believe, says, we believe and suggested a few years ago that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is the manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. So that word allergy perplexed me, you know, because I can eat enough pasta for a family of 10.
Some of us aren't finding this page.
You have the red book here? XXVI.
In the Roman numerals?
Thanks, Shannon. And let me see, if you get to the doctor's opinion, it's the fourth page of the doctor's opinion, too. That helps you out. So I always think of an allergy being is, you know, am I getting itchy skin? Am I sneezing? Are my eyes getting watery? That's, to me, is what an allergy is. So if I'm eating enough pasta for a family of 10 and I'm not getting the reaction, how can I be allergic to that? What I didn't realize was that it's not normal to eat enough pasta for a family of 10. That is my allergic reaction. Okay, so I think of it this way. Are there any alcoholics in this room too? Okay, so if I sit down next to any of these people that are alcoholics, I'm not an alcoholic. Okay, we're both going to, me and you are going to have 5 shots of tequila together. Okay? We're both going to get drunk. Because that is the normal reaction to alcohol, to get drunk. But what's going to happen to me is I'm going to feel a little bit sick, a little bit nauseous, a little bit tipsy, a little bit out of control. I do not like that feeling. And I'm not going to want any more liquor. And Patricia is going to get excited, in charge, got to have some more kind of feeling, and she's going to go out and seek more alcohol. So if 9 out of 10 people react like me, and 1 out of 10 people act like Patricia, it just means she's having an abnormal reaction. This takes the guilt, the shame, out of the idea that we are bad people because we can't stop eating. I'm just having an abnormal reaction to certain foods. So this also explains to me when I would be at a birthday party when I was a little kid, and I'd be sitting there having that one piece of cake, wanting that next piece, maybe thinking maybe if I ask the mom if she needs help cleaning up in the back, I can go back and eat all the leftovers. And my friend is sitting there, and she has a half a piece of cake, and she stops. And what I would do is I'd beat myself up higher. I'd beat myself up because I'm thinking, like, why don't I have the willpower of my friend? What I don't realize is she doesn't have willpower. She doesn't want any more cake. In fact, if she had more, she might feel a little bit sick, a little bit nauseous, and she doesn't like that feeling, which is why she's not eating anymore. I mean, have you been at a restaurant when someone has gotten dessert, had a bite, and go, oh, that's too sweet? I thought they were lying. I really did. I'm like, that's not possible. Or I had too much to eat. I don't think I'm going to be able to finish this dessert. I never felt that. So I assume, wow, what willpower. But no, it's just that they're having the normal reaction to that substance, and I have an abnormal reaction. Does that make sense to everybody?
Yes.
So when Patricia walked into AA, it was very clear to Patricia what it meant to be sober. Alcohol in any form. When you come into OA, we are gifted and challenged that my allergic foods are not your allergic foods. So that's why the doctor's opinion to me is so essential in Overeaters Anonymous, and we have to take this a little bit slower because we have to find out what is abstinent for us. I think for many of us what happens, at least my experience in Jersey, I don't know, what's abstinence? Oh, here's a food plan. You eat this food plan and you're going to be abstinent. And abstinence and a food plan are two totally different things. Abstinence has to do with refraining from those foods, those ingredients, and those behaviors that create the phenomenon of craving. that excited, jazzed up, gotta have more feeling. That idea when I have the first couple Oreos, and the 100th Oreo, I'm not even tasting it because I'm 4 sleeves in, because that feeling is intensifying and it never satisfies. So I have to identify what those foods are, and that defines my abstinence. Now, a food plan is those limits and boundaries around the foods that you do eat. And that's going to be different for each of us as well. And it might change over time. I just went through menopause. I had to change my food plan, give up a couple, you know, types of foods. Not because of my abstinence, but I had to decrease my food because my metabolism is slower. But it didn't change my abstinence. Because once that food creates that phenomenon of craving, that doesn't change. I have an allergy to penicillin. I haven't had penicillin since I was an infant. Had a bad reaction. Don't remember what it was. I was told that. I'm under no delusion that at the age of 49 that I can have penicillin and not have that reaction. And in fact, my feeling is I'll probably have a lot worse reaction because my body's a lot older. I feel the same way about my binge foods. I've been recovered now for 5 years. I don't believe if I have my binge foods, I'm going to even go back to where I was when I was binging 5 years ago. I'm going to go back as if I was binging the 5 years, because my body has aged 5 years and my resistance to those binge foods has probably decreased. Does that make sense? So when it says alcohol in any form, you know, I remember specifically a friend of mine who's dually addicted and well, someone I worked with, and she texted me because she had a really bad sore throat, and she's like, Kim, I really think if I just had some sugar-free ice cream, that would really help my throat. And I texted her back, so would a shot of whiskey. And she's like, got it. Like, I have to be as vigilant as an alcoholic about the foods that I eat. You know, an alcoholic would not have a case of bronchitis and say, well, I'm going to have cough suppressant that has alcohol in it, because it doesn't matter. And in fact, the reason I don't drink alcohol today is not because I'm an alcoholic, but because almost every alcohol has sugar in it. And sugar is one of my binge foods. So if I tonight had a couple glasses of wine, I would not be drunk tomorrow or the next day or the next day, but I'd be at a Dunkin' Donuts drive-thru, because the body doesn't care why I ingested it, and I don't even like wine. So I mean, just I don't even like. But my body would have this jazzed up, excited feeling that it would have to be satisfied 2, 3, 4 days out. Does that make sense to everybody? I'm trying. I have a low voice, sorry. So if we drop down to the bottom of that page, we're going to see what the interaction is between allergy of the body and obsession of the mind. So it says at the bottom, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life is the only normal one. So is it really that I like Oreos that much? Because if that's the case, explain to me why I eat food that's burnt. Why food that's stale. While I white knuckle it through an office business thing on Tuesday, and on Wednesday morning in the top of the trash is the leftover donuts that are stale and I eat them. Or if something is frozen and I can't wait for it to defrost, so I'm just going to eat it. I am chasing an effect. And that's what I have to understand. So anything that I'm getting that effect from has to be put down, because I'm always going to have that effect. And it seems elusive. You know, the silly example I always use is if I look at the movie Ocean's 11, and I see George Clooney, and I know he's a good-looking guy, and I agree he's a good-looking guy, but I don't see anything but Brad Pitt. I, since puberty, have loved blonde hair, blue eyes, tall men. And when I walk into a room of 50 men, I know which guys I'm going to be, you know, getting those butterflies over. I can't explain it. I didn't make a decision about it. When you go into a grocery store, what aisles do you want to go down? What aisles don't even know what's in those aisles? You know, I think this is, apparently you guys don't get snow, but when we get snow in Jersey, what's the foods I'm going out to the store for? I mean, in my alcoholic mind, I would think, well, Ding Dongs and Doritos, what if the refrigerator goes out? They're not refrigerated, so that's how I'm going to get through the snowstorm. I'm not saying to myself, well, I don't have to refrigerate Brussels sprouts and broccoli. I better get more in of that. So it is elusive, but we know what that is. What are those foods that you go to in an all-you-can-eat buffet? And then get with a recovered person who can be objective about your food and find out what are those common ingredients between those foods. Because what I would do is say, I know I can't have a Snickers bar. Can't have it. but I had a really good workout, and this protein bar is really good. And I don't like the protein bar as much. But when I put those ingredients on a Snickers bar next to a protein bar, there's really no difference. So I have to know what are those ingredients in there that's going to set up the phenomenon of craving. Because maybe I'm not going to binge today on the protein bar because I'm not really jazzed on it. But tomorrow, the next day, if it has those ingredients in it, I'm going to be eating the Snickers bars. Does that make sense to everyone? So my alcoholic life is the only normal one. You know, I don't know if you've ever talked to people about things you've done with food, and they're like, yeah, right. You know, I mean, I actually, in college, scheduled my classes during mealtime. So I had the excuse not to eat with the other kids so that I could eat, so I could go to the cafeteria on off hours and eat in my dorm room the way I wanted to eat. I don't even know if I consciously did that. I just knew that I had to eat the way I wanted to eat. I had to somehow avoid what normal people seeing what I was doing. Okay. Now let's continue. It says they are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. So this is really the obsession of the mind. So I'm abstinent. I'm having no allergic reaction. And suddenly, the best idea I've had all day is to go to the drive-thru. Why is that? Because I'm restless. I'm irritable. I'm discontent. I'm so uncomfortable in my own skin. And my experience has been the second I pick up that food, I feel ease and comfort. Now, unfortunately, that lasts 3 or 4 seconds. So I have to take the next bite and the next bite. And I always think to myself, I lived with my parents until I was in my late 20s. You know, I always talk about, you know, you lose all these things through alcohol but not through food. I'm living in my parents' house because I can't afford rent and my food. There's no way. So I didn't lose anything. I just didn't get anything. Because of my addiction, and I think most of us, our addictions start much earlier. We have access to food a lot earlier than we have access to alcohol or drugs. But what I would do is I loved icing. So I would go to the local grocery store and I'd buy icing and a cake mix. I don't think I've ever made a cake in my life, but if I buy the cake mix with the icing, it looks a lot better. Because I know that, you know, that person's judging me. So I get in line in my little cart, and I'm in line, and I can feel my shoulders starting to relax. I haven't even eaten anything yet. But just knowing that the icing is there. And then when I get to the checkout counter, I throw some M&Ms. Because I don't think I can make it from the car to my parents' house without at least having something in my mouth. So why does that happen when I'm abstinent? Because my real problem is I can't be abstinent comfortably. And I don't have any other coping skills but to pick up the food, which unfortunately is now killing me. Does that make sense to everybody?
Yes.
Okay. So if we are 3-4 days abstinent and we want that food more than anything, that's the allergy of the body coupled with the mental obsession. But if we're 3-4 weeks out, then that can't be the allergy. It's not. There's no allergic reaction going on. It has to be the mental obsession. So why is it we have, I don't even, do you guys do chips in this area for
yes.
days? I mean, how many 30-day chips do we give out compared to how many 60-day chips and 90-day chips? Why can we white-knuckle it for 30 days but not the 60 or the 90? It's not because of the allergy. It's because of the mental obsession. And we're going to learn in here that the allergy is addressed through abstinence. The mental obsession is only addressed through the step work. So if we are only doing abstinence and, you know, support from our fellowship, which is strong, it's really strong, and it'll work until it doesn't work, then we're not going to be able to have any type of long-term abstinence if we're the alcoholic of this type that we're going to describe in here. So let's look at how they interact together. After they have succumbed to the desire again, so the desire is the mental obsession. I can't stand still. Oh my God, what am I going to do? F it. And you take that first bite. And I love the definition of succumb. It says to yield or to surrender to a superior force. Isn't that exactly how it feels? That obsession is on you and it's the only thing you can think about. It's like there's this room peripherally, and when that mental obsession comes in, I'm looking through a straw, and that's all I can see until I succumb. And this is my opinion. I always like to differentiate this stuff, but my opinion is we do a real disservice to our fellowship when we talk about slips. Because a slip is an accidental fall. I remember two specific phone calls I got. I got a girl that called me and left me a message saying that she had a slip, but her sponsor said it's okay and she doesn't have to count her days over because we're so attached to the number of days that we have. And I said, can you tell me what happened? She's like, I was out to dinner with my family and I had dessert. I said, okay, so can we agree that a slip is an accidental fall? Yes. So you're saying that you're out to dinner, you talk to the waiter, you ask him for a dessert menu, you look at the dessert menu, you decide what you're going to have, you wait till he comes back, you give him the order, he goes back to the kitchen, brings it out, you pick up the fork and you eat the dessert. That's not a slip. That is succumbing to the desire again. And we have to take that seriously, otherwise we're going to continue to be going back into the food. I don't even consider that a relapse, because relapse means that you did the step work and then went back to the food. If you're just trying to white knuckle it through a food plan, that's just the progression of the illness. And what you're going to find is it's going to get shorter periods of abstinence and longer, more vicious periods of being in the food. The second phone call I got was a couple weeks later, ironically, where a girl said, I just want to tell myself, you know, I had a slip today. I worked overtime, was running late. I don't eat flour, but I stopped off and I had a whole grain muffin. Since it's whole grain, I'm going to consider it a slip. So I called her back and I said, can I tell you what I heard? And she's like, sure. Hi, my name is Kim. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a gin and tonic girl. I worked late, had to stop by a happy hour, had a couple Coors Lights. I don't like Coors Lights. I'm going to consider myself sober. And she said, oh my God, I'm in AA. Did I sound that insane? I'm like, absolutely. So we have to know that we have to have the food down. And for those of you that this terrifies, that's good, first of all. But secondly, that's why starting step work is so essential, because you're not going to get relief from that mental obsession until you get through the steps. And that's why we put the food down and immediately get into step work. And we focus on the solution and be willing to be uncomfortable while we go through that, because I can promise you that the big book promises us neutrality around the food at the end of the steps. And I have had the experience over the last 5 years of not wanting my binge foods. I had 6 years of white-knuckled abstinence in the 90s when I first came into OA. I felt every frickin' minute of it. It was so painful. I have to think about how long I've been abstinent now, because it's effortless. Now, the step work is a lot of work, but being abstinent is effortless because the mental obsession stays removed as long as I continue the step work. So this is what it's saying. After they succumb to the desire again, as many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, so once again a reminder, the craving does not start unless we pick up the food. They pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. I swear to God, this is the last time. Monday, 11:59, I'm binging. I might as well finish this box because, you know, I'm not going to have it again, so I better finish this one. But I swear to God, tomorrow's going to be different. January 1st, my life is starting over. And this is going to be repeated over and over and over unless this person can experience an entire psychic change. And the two things that really stand out to me in this chapter is it tells us in a couple pages that the only suggestion they have from relief from the allergy is entire abstinence. And now they're telling us the only relief we have from the mental obsession is an entire psychic change. I don't know about you guys, but I did the OA waltz for years. Steps 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And as soon as I felt a little bit of relief, I'd go back to doing whatever I wanted to do, and then I'd wonder how I got there. It's because I never had an entire psychic change. I would have spiritual awarenesses, but never a spiritual experience. So this is telling us that, number one, if I want it, twofold illness, do you have the allergy of the body, fully conceived? I'm deciding whether to be judgmental, and I think I'm going to be. There's groups in OA, and I don't know your area, so I'm talking specifically about some phone meetings, that don't believe in the physical allergy. They believe this is totally a behavior. And because of that, they encourage people to eat their way through the steps. I just ask you to check your own experience. Have you been able to work the steps in the food? And have you been able to have any kind of relief for any long period of time? If someone is telling you that message, are they still morbidly obese? If someone is telling you that message, have they been able to have any type of long-term abstinence? Can they even define their abstinence? So the big book is telling you, if I don't have an allergy, then I'm not a compulsive overeater. It's also telling you, if I don't have a mental obsession, I'm not a compulsive overeater. So for example, I have friends that tell me once they open up a bag of Doritos, they have to eat the whole bag. And I said, tell them, well, what do? And they look at me, I don't open up the bag of Doritos. See, they don't have the mental obsession. They have the sanity to understand they can't stop eating the bag of Doritos, so they don't open up the bag. Now, they're not a compulsive overeater. Even though if I was sitting down with them in front of a football game, we'd look the same the way we eat if that bag was opened. I also have a friend that loves chocolate. Loves, loves, loves chocolate. And every day, she looks forward to coming home and having chocolate. And she has a bag of Hershey Kisses. And she has one Hershey Kiss. And I've seen her have that Hershey Kiss. And she does get that feeling. But believe it or not, if she has a bag of 30 Hershey Kisses, do you know how long it lasts?
30 days.
Sometimes even 32. Because she might forget to have one day. I think she has a problem, personally. But she doesn't have the physical allergy. So she has this obsession about chocolate. But because she doesn't have the allergy, she actually gets satiated when she has a piece of chocolate. So this chapter is telling me and asking me, do I have both? Okay, so does that make sense to everybody?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm not going to go over Bill's story. I'm just going to tell you how I go over Bill's story. If you guys want to try it, you know, try it at home. Is Bill's story, I is divided into three spaces the way I look at it. It's pages 1 to 8 is step one. It's his descent into the madness of alcoholism. Pages 8 to 12 is step two. And then pages 13 and 14, he goes through with the rest of the steps. So when you look over pages 1 through 8, what I want you to do is forget this is a guy from New York City, that East Coast. Forget that he's a stockbroker. Forget he's a World War I veteran. What you want to look at is identify in. Do you eat like Bill drank? Do you feel like Bill felt? And do you think like Bill thinks? Because what 1 through 8 will tell you is what it feels like to be an alcoholic. We've just read a medical diagnosis, but how does that look in a human being? And what you want to look at is the progression of your illness mimic his. So we're going to see in his story, it goes from fun and excitement, he's hanging out in the country clubs and the jazz clubs, to necessity, where he's got to have it. Used to be something he did on the weekends. I don't know, but that really mimics my experience. I can hold it out till the weekends, and then suddenly it's every day. I'm no longer eating because I need relief. I'm eating because I can't do life without it. And then it progresses to oblivion. And that's how it was for me. At the end, the food, the best it could do was I could feel nothing. And I would settle for that because feeling was so painful that I would choose oblivion over the pain of living. Does that make sense? So that's what you can do. Go through the chapter that way. And you'll see, actually, that the big book kind of mimics the way Bill's story is. We're going to spend a lot of time. And today, the way that I look at the big book is that doctor's opinion, Bill's story, there is a solution, more about alcoholism, is all step one. And we're going to go over that tonight. Then we agnostics is step two, a whole chapter on step two. Then in how it works, it's steps 3 and 4. And then into action is steps 5 through 11 in one chapter. And then step 12, which is carrying this message, is the chapter working with others. And then practicing these principles in all of our affairs is the following chapters. Where do we practice our affairs? In our homes, in our jobs, and in our communities? So those are the chapters to the wives, the family afterwards, and to the employer. So the big book mimics it. The hardest part for us to do is identify in. Do we need this work? Because all step one is a conclusion. I did not work step one out in the rooms. I worked step one out in a Cinnabon, binging my brains out, and in parking lots of convenience stores. That's where I came to the conclusion in step one. And step two is to be the conclusion that I need a power. Okay? So we're going to go into the chapter. There is a solution, which starts on page 17. And even in that first paragraph, since it was a pretty depressing diagnosis we just went over, here's some hope. It says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem. So it's past tense. And I know when I first started looking at the Big Book, I've been in OA since 94. I got introduced to the Big Book in a serious way about 5 years ago. And when I heard that word recovered, I bristled at that. Those arrogant SOBs, who do they think they are? All of our literature says recovering. But what I understand in the Big Book is that I think it's like 10 or 12 times it says recovered. Only one time in the Big Book it says recovering. And it's when they're telling a wife what their husband is like while they're going through the process. Recovering was something that really came out of the rehabs in the 70s, saying you were always going to be sick. And if you think about it, that makes sense because we were founded in 62, so our growth was really during the 70s, during the rehab world. So we were just adapting what AA was doing during the 70s. So that's one of the reasons, I think, my opinion, that's why we adopted that language, recovering. So what I realize now is recovered, which is what I am, is the most humble thing I can say today. Because that's letting you know that a power greater than myself has relieved my mental obsession. When I said recovery for those 17 years, I was saying, look what Kim is doing. Kim is going to 3 meetings a week. Kim is making 3 phone calls. Kim found the perfect sponsor. Kim is doing this. I'm your inner group chair. I'm on the region board. I was hustling for recovery. It was all ego-driven. Recovered, to me, if I don't say recovered, I'm slapping my higher power in the face. And I'm disregarding what the higher power has done for me that I cannot do for myself. So really, the word recovered to me is the most humble thing that I say. And we're going to go over that later about what that state looks like. Okay? So let's talk about, because the way I divide this chapter into 2 sections too, 17 to 24 is really more about the problem. Because a big part of knowing who I am is knowing who I am not. Okay, so what we're going to do is go to page, at the bottom of page 20. Actually, in the middle of the page, the third paragraph down, how many times people have said this to us. So this is questions, not that other compulsive overeaters ask us. These are the questions of the people who love us, the doctors, the family members. Because what they're doing is they're seeing what the food does to me, the obesity, the high blood pressure, the cholesterol, the wanting to have a boyfriend but feeling too fat to go out. They're seeing what the food does to me. And all I know is what the food does for me. So the people who love me are going to ask me, why can't you take it or leave it alone? Why? Because they can. Why doesn't he eat like a gentleman or quit? That fellow can't handle his liquor. Why don't you try beer and wine? That's a big one. Why don't you try organic? Be a vegan. You know, why don't you just eat just shop at Whole Foods. I don't know if you have Whole Foods out here. Yeah. Just shop at Whole Foods. Have the diabetic form of that your favorite thing. His willpower must be weak. That hurt. That really hurt because I wanted it. I so wanted to stop. She's such a sweet girl, I should think he would stop for her sake. You really want a boyfriend, Kim? Why don't you want to go to the prom? Why don't you stop eating? The doctor told him if he ever drank again, it would kill him, but there he is, all lit up again. You know, I think one of my best friends is a doctor, and she had called me one night, and she's known me since I was 9, and I'll tell you, she still doesn't get it. She still thinks, she doesn't understand why I still go to OA, and she doesn't need to, but she's someone who's seen me go through my whole journey. But she had a patient that was having a diabetic, 450 pounds, was having her toes cut off the next morning from the gout or whatever that is, from diabetes. And she went in the night before and couldn't believe she found her eating cheesecake with her family. She's like, what is she doing? And in my head, I thought to myself, in my disease, I would have said, I'm losing the toes anyways. I might as well enjoy the cheesecake. It's not going to make a difference now. So that's why people don't understand. Now, these are commonplace observations on drinking, which we hear all the time. Back of them is a world of ignorance and misunderstanding. We see that these expressions refer to people whose reactions are very different than ours. Okay, so they don't understand, and they don't need to. That's why we need the rooms. That's why we have to be in a room where people understand our truth and will not put up with our bullshit either. So here's the different types of drinkers. Moderate drinkers have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely. If they have good reason to, they can take it or leave it alone. So this is like my dad, who, before vacation, will weigh himself, and he'll go away for 10 days, and he'll gain 10 pounds. Because enjoying the food is and the local cuisine is a big part of the vacation. But he simply comes home, he weighs himself, and he curbs his eating and loses the weight, and he's fine. Is that your experience?
No.
Now we have a certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit barely enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time if a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative. This man can also stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome and may even need medical attention. So this might even be some of your binge buddies. And they come to you one day and they say, my doctor told me I have diabetes. I got to stop eating like this. And they do. That's a hard eater. Consequences. This is the wife that their husband says, listen, when I married you 20 years ago, I wasn't marrying this. You put on all this weight. I'm not going to stay with you if you don't lose the weight. And the person loses the weight, and that's it. I've had consequence after consequence after consequence with the food. Like I said, I've had it through bulimia. I've had it through obesity. I've had it from being underweight. Nothing has ever stopped me. Now, one of the ways I understand what this is like, too, is I am your hard drinker. I didn't drink till I went to college. I drank alcoholically for 10 years. I can probably go into an AA meeting and tell a darn good story. But at the age of 27, I was at a club, and me and my friend, because this was during my bulimia, so I had lost, and this is the insanity, like I had lost some weight and got promiscuous because I knew I couldn't keep it up. So I was going to have to try to pack in life in the short period of time I was going to be able to be that, like a size, because 14 was the magical size. When I got to a size 14, I could live life now. So I was at a club and I was less drunk than my friend. So I drove and we went down the wrong way down a highway and it almost killed us both. And I stopped drinking. I just stopped drinking there. Now let's say I got caught that time I drank and drove, or the many times I drank and drove, what would the court system have done? They would have labeled me an alcoholic. I would have gone into an AA meeting. They would have said, put the plug in the jug, don't drink, go to meetings, and I would have been an AA success story because I can do that. I am not an alcoholic. Now, the scary thing is, if someone in AA, seeing me being sober and happy, would have said, can you sponsor me? Sure. Don't drink and go to meetings. And I would have killed alcoholics with that message because an alcoholic can't do that. So unfortunately, we have to accept the reality. There's people in OA who are the hard eaters, who are the moderate eaters, who coming in and being given a food plan and being told, girl, you can do it, is enough for them. And in the most loving and supportive way, they tell me to do the same thing. And I don't understand why I can't. Why can't I make 3 phone calls and stay abstinent? Because that was my experience. I'm just talking from my experience. I had 6 years of abstinence, white-knuckled. And this is the insane alcoholic thinking. I'm on the region board. They want me to try out for World Service Trustee. And in my alcoholic mind, I don't know how to say no. So I think, if I pick up, I'm not qualified. And I'll just get back on track. But then I can get out of this question they want me to do. And I never got more than 8 months after that. My disease had progressed that I could not keep the food down after that. So what would happen when I pick up the food again? I would come in and they'd say, Kim, what happened? And I would tell them, you're not going to enough meetings. Oh! And I would go to a meeting every single night. And that would work until it didn't. And then I would come back from another relapse and I'd say, Kim, what happened? And I would tell them, you're not making enough phone calls. And I would make more phone calls, and that would work until it didn't. So I just want to preface that people who are telling you that, they're saying it with the best of intentions, and it might even be their reality. But if you're identifying in with the compulsive overeater in this book, it's not going to be sufficient for you to stay out of the food and happy. I know a lot of people that can do that and are crazy. I mean, I know about you, but I mean, I got to the many times people wanted to throw candy bars at me. Frickin' eat. You talk about our life being unmanageable. I am unmanageable by other people when I'm abstinent only, because I'm insane. I have no buffer against life when I'm abstinent. Okay? So it says, but what about the real alcoholic? He may start off as a moderate eater. He may or may not become a continuous hard eat drinker, but at some stage of the drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. Is that your reality? Okay. So let's go to the top of page 23. We talked a lot about this allergy, where it says these observations, and what are the observations? The observations of the allergy would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. So let's just use an abstract example. Let's say I have a really extreme reaction to poison ivy, but I love to hike, which I found out today I don't. We're going to go over the fear inventory. I have a very current fear. We went to the top of that hellish mountain. I don't know what it was. I thought I was going to die. Thank God. Mount Tam. I was scared to death. So someone hiking on flat ground, let's put it that way. Extremely allergic to poison ivy. But they take precautions. They wear clothes that cover every inch of their body. They know what poison ivy looks like. They know where it tends to be on their trails. And they can walk the trails. And they can enjoy the sunshine and the birds singing and all the nature. Do you think they're crazy because they have an allergy to poison ivy? I don't. But what if that same person takes all those precautions and is walking in the woods, and all of a sudden they can't hear the birds, they don't see the sunshine, so they're thinking, that's poison ivy. That's poison ivy. That's poison ivy. That's poison ivy. And finally they strip down to their underwear and they roll in the poison ivy. Do you think that person's insane? Yes. But are they insane because they have the allergy? Or are they insane because they have a mind that tells them it's okay to roll around in the poison ivy? Our main problem is in our mind. Another way, once again, to knowing who I am is knowing who I am not. I am not someone that has a problem with shopping. Do you guys have Costco?
Yes.
Okay, so Costco is a big thing in my area, and I hear people getting out of control with the Costco, and they're spending too much money. And I don't have a problem with money. And I just, what I would say to them, listen, make a list. Don't buy anything off the list. Set a dollar amount. Don't go above that dollar amount. If you really have that big of a problem, only go to Costco every 2 months, for God's sake. Control yourself. Now, if you switch that into food, oh, come on, Kim. Just write down what you're buying in the store and don't get anything in that aisle. Limit yourself to 1,500 calories, or how many points, or whatever it is in the Weight Watcher system. If you have that big of a problem with pizza, only go to the pizza joint once every 2 months. Do you see now how different it is in something you don't have a problem with? And once again, people are lovingly giving us advice that we cannot take. Okay, so let's turn to page 24, and let's look with the real alcoholic, what we're subject to. That squiggly writing means it's important. I don't know if it's squiggly writing in your book?
Yeah.
It is? Okay. It says, the first paragraph, the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. So I don't know if anyone's been into a rehab, but when you go to a rehab, what's the first question they ask you? What's your drug of choice? So if I checked into a rehab today, I can honestly say my drug of choice is alcohol. I drank alcoholically and I chose not to. I can say it's marijuana. I smoked marijuana in college, and I have to tell you the reason I did is because they have good binge foods. They always had the Cheetos. And then I chose not to. I have chosen over and over again not to eat, and yet I do it again. I don't know, once again, I'm on the other coast, but that was a popular saying. Today, I choose not to eat. And we'd say it in a meeting. If that's your truth, you're not the alcoholic that I am. How often do we hear in the rooms, oh, just play the tape through. Think of the consequences. Keep it green. Remember your last drunk. Hear the war stories. How many of you guys listen to Vision for You? Okay, well, geez. So, how many of you ever been to a binge and thought, man, I can't binge. Remember what Harlan said last week? Remember what Leia said? Whoosh! I heard she said that this morning. Her whoosh! That makes me, I'm not going to eat. I don't have the ability to remember. I don't have a choice. That's why I'm a compulsive overeater. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory and the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. So at certain times, which is why at certain times a meeting works. At certain times a phone call works. At certain times there was this wedding in 1993 that I was able to eat like a lady, and I'm going to try to get back there, even though every wedding since I've hid in the bathroom to eat. So I think of it this way. I think of it like the game Russian roulette. You have a gun with six chambers in it. Okay? You have one bullet in one of the chambers. And you think, I'm willing to take the chance. But the insanity is my progression. My disease goes from fun and excitement to necessity to oblivion. I now have five bullets in the chamber. And I'm still willing to pull that trigger every time on the hopes that this will be the time that I'll be able to control and enjoy my eating. And I had to understand, I had to really get the fact that I was without defense against the first drink. It wasn't the third donut. It wasn't halfway through the bag of Doritos. I was without defense. I did not have the mental capacity. My mind is twisted and will always convince me that I can have just one. Does that make sense to everybody? Doesn't it suck? It sucks. So it dropped to the bottom of the page. When this sort of thinking is fully established in the individual with alcoholic tendencies, he has probably placed himself beyond human aid. And unless locked in, he may die or go permanently insane. These stark and ugly facts have been confirmed by legions of alcoholics throughout history. But for the grace of God, there would have been thousands more convincing demonstrations. So many want to stop but cannot. So beyond human aid, you know, unfortunately means your meetings, your sponsor. That's why we have to get a connection with a power greater than ourselves. The fellowship can support us, but it's the step work that's going to change us. And if we are an alcoholic of this type, we're going to need that psychic change. So now we go to page 25. 25 to 29 is really about the solution. I've heard the joke, if you want to hide something from an alcoholic, put it in the big book. So they hid the solution in a chapter called There is a Solution. And they put it in squiggly writing so we can't see it. At the top of 25, the first paragraph, there is a solution. And it says, almost none of us like. That was big to me. I thought I had to like it. You know, I got to get comfortable in my abstinence before I do these steps. I'm not comfortable with that without the steps. I don't need to come to OA. None of us like it. Do it anyways. So I love when Bill kind of summarizes the steps. So here's his summarizing step. None of us like the self-searching, which is step 4, the leveling of our pride, which is 5 through 7, the confession of shortcomings, which is 8 through 9, which this process requires for a successful consummation. So we often talk about everything in OA as a suggestion. And it's true. You know, the 12 steps are suggested. But I got a secret. It's the only suggestion we got. But it's only a suggestion. But once you take that suggestion, you're going to see there's a lot of musts, a lot of always, a lot of nevers. And you don't have to do them either. But someone very lovingly said to me, stop complaining, you're not getting the results if you're not willing to do the work. And I was like, oof, that's true. In the meeting we had this morning, we read the promises at the end. Once again, my experience, no one ever told me those were 9-step promises. I thought, when do I get them? 30 days, 60 days, 6 months? Those promises are the result of working steps 1 through 9. If you haven't worked one step, 1 through 9, don't think those promises are going to come true for you. Okay? And successful consummation. Do you want successful consummation? That's what someone asked me too. Do you want, you know, how free do you want to be? And for many years, I was willing to be comfortably miserable in these rooms, unfortunately. So if we drop down to that next paragraph, the great fact is just this and nothing less. That we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude towards life, towards our fellows, and towards God's universe. The first 17 years in OA, I had a lot of deep experiences. Coming into a room of people who understood what I did with food was a deep experience. People who would unconditionally love me was a deep spiritual experience. My fourth step, it's kind of interesting. That's about it. But was it effective? I had to admit it. I was in a 5-year relapse. I had to admit it wasn't effective. So do I want a deep and effective experience? And it says it has revolutionized our whole attitude. Nah, I would change it with you guys because you love me. And I would go out and I would wreak havoc on the world. So I have to change my whole attitude. Revolutionize. Everything is going to have to change if I want to be free from this disease. And then we go down to that last paragraph, where it's asking us that question. If you are seriously alcoholic as we were, do you believe that you are the real compulsive overeater? Do you believe you suffer from the alcoholic torture that was described in that doctor's opinion? We believe there is no middle of the road solution. And the middle of the road solution is don't drink and go to meetings. That middle of the road solution is 3 meetings a week and 3 phone calls a day. And I just want to say this because I always get touted as a tool basher. I guess because I kind of do, but what I believe is that it's very easy to work the tools and not work the steps. I believe it's impossible to work the steps and not work the tools. So I think of it this way: if I had a piece of wood here, and I had a screwdriver, a hammer, and a wrench, and I just had nails and screws and was doing anything on it, would it mean anything? Not really. But if I wanted to build a doghouse for my dog, how else am I going to do it unless I have those tools? So I have to know what I'm building. You know, I was someone, I don't know if it's the same, but that was the formula in my area: 3 meetings a week, 3 phone calls a day, and you will stay abstinent. I don't abide by that anymore. I work the steps, the program of recovery. And let me tell you, I attend Vision for You 5 days a week. I go to an AA meeting, and I go to my home group OA meeting. So I'm attending 7 meetings a week by not going to meetings. By not making 3 phone calls a day, which for me was, you know, hi, how's your day? Thank you. Click. Oh, thank God they didn't answer. Click. That counts, right? I dialed the phone. And today I work with a lot of people. I probably average 7 to 10 phone calls a day by not trying to make phone calls. So I think the tools are essential, but they are not the solution if we're not working the steps as a reason to do the tools. We passed through the region from which there was no return from human aid, and we had but 2 alternatives. And this couple sentences was what made me scared enough to work the steps. We had 2 alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could. And the other was to accept spiritual help. So I thought the intolerable situation was being in the food, which makes logical sense why I thought abstinence was the answer. When someone explained to me the intolerable situation as being abstinent, I'd be like, you have to be abstinent in the morning and the afternoon and the evening? I mean, when people would say, oh, I've been back-to-back abstinent for, you know, I thought they were lying too. I'm like, there's no way anyone could be back-to-back abstinent. That's insane. That's way too painful. That's what's intolerable. So when I'm in that place where I'm in an intolerable situation of being abstinent only, I have 2 alternatives. One, to blot out the consciousness, and the best way I did is to pick up the food. Or the other was to go for spiritual help, which is the 12 steps. So if I'm in that intolerable situation of just being abstinent and white knuckling, I got my 30-day chip, what do I do at day 31? Am I going to pick up the food or pick up the steps? Pick up the food or pick up the steps? Okay? So we are right now at 7:10. What I'd like to do is open up for any questions you guys might have, and then take a 10-minute break, and we'll start again at 7:30. So does anybody have any questions or comments or things you don't agree with or want to clarify?
So you described this physical allergy.